Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yes, Sci-Fi, a podcast about science fiction audiobooks hosted by three men, all of whom are exactly who they seem to be.
I'm the Geck.
I can see that. You can swim down.
Yeah, I got some gills.
Great. I'm sure that that meant a lot to our loyal listeners.
I just like the name Geck.
Okay, Geck, what is this week's title?
Providence by Anne Leckie, narrated by Adjoa Ando.
Okay. Could you give us a reading from the back of the book, please?
A power-driven young woman has just one chance to secure the status she craves and regain priceless lost artifacts prized by her people. She must free their thief from a prison planet from which no one has ever returned. Ingray and her charge will return to her homeworld to find their planet in political turmoil, at the heart of an escalating interstellar conflict. Together, they must make a new plan to salvage Ingray's future, her family, and her world before they are lost to her for good.
All right. Kevin, what did you think?
It was fine.
Great. Barry. Or, sorry, Geck.
Yes.
What was your take on this?
I liked it well enough. I mean, I think I liked the beginning of it more than the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
At first, I thought it was sort of like a Big Lebowski movie where it's like someone who's like completely out of their depth the entire time. So I'm not sure who makes that Walter and who's Donnie and all that. But
I was having sort of a similar reaction. I was trying to turn it into a Marx Brothers movie because there's just all kinds of mistaken identity. And the main character is sort of competent, but is sometimes shockingly naive and seems to sort of stumble from place to place.
Is that how is that how crime works?
Yes, that is how crime works. I am an international expert on how crime works.
Okay.
Good.
Yeah, okay.
Step one, go in with a plan.
Yes, great.
As opposed to just going in.
Book review.
Oh, we weren't talking about real life?
Were you done with your review?
Yes.
Okay.
Have you?
Well, let's see. Yeah, like I was saying, I really started out liking this one a lot. Because I was sort of seeing it as, like you were saying, you know, kind of a comedy, because her previous books I'd enjoyed quite a bit, but they were a little bit more down in mood, I felt, because they were, you know, revenge stories.
Yeah, they had a more serious tone.
Military, yes. So I was sort of seeing this as kind of a new direction, because I was really seeing it as this sort of naive character who's out of her depth and nobody is what they seem. And everything seemed to be like a fairly comic sort of approach to everything. So, like I was saying, I read it as a screwball comedy. And then it seemed to switch to be a mystery genre. Well, that's okay. You can have a screwball comedy mystery. And then there was another genre and another one. And it overloaded my ability to take it as a screwball comedy. And then things got serious. And I didn't really know how to take it anymore. So I'm not entirely sure if I was reading this book upside down the entire time. It's perfectly possible that this is a perfectly good entry into a genre I do not understand.
I don't think it was intended to be a comedy from the beginning, but I mean, there were comedic elements, but it was more of a mystery, right?
Sure. Well, we'll get into the mystery in the spoiler section, but one of my problems is I didn't feel like everything was wrapped up. This is a very well-written book. I really liked all of the characters. I just did not feel very fulfilled at the end of it. I was just like, what?
Yeah, I think for me, this kind of hit that uncomfortable neutral review section where you're like, it wasn't like, wow, it's amazing, or, you know, no, it was horrible, or, you know, anything like that. It was pretty good, but it didn't catch me. And I wasn't like, oh my God, what's going to happen next? You know? So it's that uncomfortable, pretty good, you know, stage.
Yeah. We should probably just have a shorthand of, yeah, it was pretty good.
Right. And so
save us time and probably some nasty glances from people.
Right.
And pitchfork attacks.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, of course, it could just be me and everything feeling blasé or something.
It is. It's just you.
Yeah.
It's all everything about is you, gray Kevin. And
meaningless. No, that's just all the books are gray and meaningless. Not me.
Drifting through space without form. There's Kevin.
Yeah. So then the other thing that I'll mention, because it's not really a secret or anything, is the neutral pronouns that that happened. And so what, there's something that happens when you listen to an audiobook, yes, versus reading, is your ears do it, right? Yeah. And so when you can't see that it's written as E, you know, right.
Plus if the narrator has an English accent, some right, dialects of which drop H's, then you suddenly right, think that maybe she's just doing a particular accent.
Yeah. I'm yeah, like, is this like a Cockney accent of some kind that I'm not that familiar with? You know, it's right, like, what's going on? And so for a while, I just didn't know. And then, you know, I knew that in her previous books, you know, everyone was referred to as she. And then later on, of course, after I finished the book, I'd read other things where she's like, well, you know, this sort of expands the possibilities. You know, people get to choose what, you know, how they're identified, essentially.
Sure. And neutral pronouns are nothing terribly new.
I'm right,
personally quite in favor of them. But yeah. And so I think since we were listening to them in an audiobook and
sometimes faster than
sometimes
its regular speed,
1.5x speed, Barry, I believe you said you didn't even notice it.
I did not notice it till maybe near the end of the book at the first pass. And then the second pass, when I started it, re-listened to the first hour or so, I started to notice it a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. So obviously, I don't think that it gets in the way of enjoying the story.
No.
So yeah, that didn't really rile us up anymore. Okay. Well then I guess it's time for us to be freed from the prison planet of the reviews section and rejoin you in the larger world of the discussion section.
It's not a prison, it's compassionate release.
Thank you.
Do I get served Twinkies all the time in compassionate release?
Oh no, compassionate removal, I guess. Sorry.
Compassionate release is something else. Anyway, we'll take a brief break to be placed in hibernation pods. But before that, let's talk for a minute. Do you have a book that you'd like us to review? Something you think we'd love or maybe hate in an amusing way? If so, please tell us about it. You can reach us on Twitter at SF3Podcast or via email at sf3podcast@gmail.com. All identifiers use the numeral 3. All of them. We also appreciate reviews in the Apple Podcast app or iTunes. And we shall return, for we are sci-fi.
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 And welcome back to our discussion of Provenance by Anne Leckie. So, yeah, the biggest problem that I had with this was there was a murder and all the setup of a classic sort of mystery.
It's a whodunit.
And then relatively quickly, we settled on a suspect. That person was arrested. And although somebody else was suspected more or less for convenience, because they were an escaped convict that was around at the time.
Doesn't have an identity.
That whole mystery seemed to kind of go away. Didn't understand who was supposed to be the actual killer.
I think they kind of said that was just a convenience, right? I mean, yes, there was a murder that happened, but I don't think that was the central.
So yeah, who killed who? Did I just miss something?
Nobody cares.
It actually didn't seem to make much of a difference in the book, to be honest.
Well, then what was the point?
Well, they did actually kind of go out of their way to say there wasn't a lot of point. It was just a redirect, you know, for them to have fake outrage about.
About what?
I mean, the whole point of the whole thing was vestiges for half of it, right?
Sure. You
know, your identity based on...
Right. And there's a whole theme of people and things not being authentic or, having false identities. And I really love that. That's one of my favorite kinds of themes. So I was assuming that the mystery was somehow also tied to all of this. It seemed like a big deal at the time. And I given that they arrested somebody that was, technically speaking, supposed to be the only person on the planet that could carry out the murder, but they never actually said why they would do it.
There was no apparent motive.
There was no apparent motive. That's the term, yes.
I had no idea it was coming, Your Honor.
Yeah, I think they basically said it had to be this person, but that person never would have done it. So they didn't. I don't think they actually did resolve exactly for sure who did it.
And I'm sure it's something being saved up from the next book, but I don't think that that's fair.
They actually aren't dead is the answer.
Of course they're not dead. They're a fictional character.
Oh.
They're actually being cloned as we speak, and they will rise as a future army of guys who died by the knife.
Yes. Was it a guy? I don't remember.
I don't remember, to be honest.
Great.
After they resolved, quote, end quote, the mystery of
I don't know. I actually thought this was a rather minor part of the book, and that it was more like the whole vestige thing was more of the mystery, not that someone happened to get murdered or whatever.
Then why was it there?
Well, so I read something where the author said that originally she was going to write about archaeology and alien artifacts, and then it kind of, you know, evolved from there. So I think that had to be in there because that was like a core part of the original idea of the book.
Oh, okay. So it's an editing mistake, basically.
I think it was, you know, that it concept was probably had more of a core.
A vestige from the previous draft.
Wow.
Well done, sir. Well done.
Okay. So possibly I'm just sort of the person that came out of Buckaroo Banzai saying, but why was there a watermelon there? He said, I'll tell you later. And then he never did.
That's just one of those things to see if you were paying attention or not.
I was, so I'm rewarded with rage. Okay.
At least you got your reward.
So the other kind of goofy thing was, you know, early on, it was like, you know, is it Pallad or not? Because, like, you know, she
it's wakes Pallad, not Pallad, Pallad.
Yeah, she wakes him up. And she's like, oh, are you Pallad? And he's like, nope.
Oh, yeah.
And then she's like, damn, I got screwed. You know, I paid all this money to get him out of compassionate removal, i.e. life imprisonment.
Right.
And, you know, it's basically escape from New York or whatever. And they, you know, he says it's not him. So she's like, oh, crap. And then I'm thinking that right when I saw that, Michael, okay, odds on whether this is really Pallad or not. You know, they give supposed evidence that it's not. And then, boink, it is. And then you're thinking later on, well, is this like another switch? Like, is it really not Pallad? And he's just somehow going along with it, but that seemed unlikely at that point. So
you mean it's the double reversal?
Yeah.
We got somebody out of jail and I'm going to say it's actually not me, even though it's really not me. And I'm going to pretend at some later point that it is me. So
that he can. But I can somehow pass. I mean, it was at least somewhat indicated that they had run DNA tests when he was in police custody and that he was Pallad Brudukim, but then
they delete his identity from the right. database, right? When you go into compassionate removal,
you're dead. Therefore, so why bother to store it?
Right. Delete the record.
Yeah, I don't know if they did that or not.
But, you know, deleting those family IDs when you get separated at the border. You don't need those anymore. You're not a family.
Moving on.
Yeah, so that was kind of like the first part. And then I kind of, the first part of this book, I thought, oh, they're getting a crew together. It's like we have
that was the other thing. The other genre that I thought that this might be was a heist movie.
Yeah. So that's kind of where I thought the book was going.
It's going to become like, you know, Gek 11 or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there like, okay, they got the, you know, the unknown, maybe Gek, the captain of her ship and maybe a stolen ship. They got the,
well, he is considered part of the Gek empire, but he's not.
Right. But at that point in the book, you don't know.
Right.
You're just like, there's maybe a stolen ship, maybe not. You got the, you know, the,
it's like, actually, I stole three of them.
Right. the main character who's, you know, adopted from a public crush. So, you know, it's like she may or may not, you know, be part of a big family if she's named that way.
Right.
And then we got
the ambiguity squad.
Right.
We don't even know if we were robbed.
We got the person who's been removed from compassionate removal. And
exactly.
And, you know, they're a forger and you're like, okay, this is going to be a great, you know, crew for something. And then that doesn't happen.
Is that like Operation Malicious, you know, removal?
Removed from the removal.
Great.
Yes.
It was clever,
wasn't it? Malicious placement.
So yeah, I mean, and that may yet happen, right? You know, by the end of the book, that still is a possible crew.
Sure. But at the end of, say, Ancillary Justice, we knew who the ancillary was. We had a better grasp of the story. Maybe not every single thing had an answer, but, you know, there was a good solid resolution at the end of that one. I just think it's a better idea to wrap things up at the end of a novel, even if it's a first installment in a series. Call me crazy.
Crazy.
Thank you. I knew that was going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think there was a lot of the themes kind of outweighed some of the where it was going.
Right. And of course, I don't want to talk about all the many things I liked about this book. I must jump up and down upon the small things I disliked.
Good. Well, that's normally my job, but
okay. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of really interesting play with ambiguity and identity. And of course, that's the whole theme of the book, that the entire power structure of this civilization rests on these vestiges, which are these sort of, you know, collections of antiques that these families build up to prove how powerful that they are, I guess.
I actually want to go to Washington, D.C. now and point at the U.S. Constitution and go, ephemera, vestige.
Right.
I believe you would be arrested.
You can't point at it and say that.
You can't.
Oh, I can't?
Well, no, those words are too big.
Wow. You got to keep them short, four letters or less.
Exactly.
Good. Not good.
Old thinkers unbelly feel ink sock.
Yes.
Unbelly feel.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was definitely a lot about identity and kind of the more I was thinking about it, you know, so there's all these things that, you know, tell a story, you know, which there's an implicit story that often is trying to be told by something, right?
Sure.
And in this book, they kind of talk about, well, the vestiges, you know, are more than just like, oh, here's a thing. They kind of imbue authority. They have almost, in this society, kind of a spiritual power about them and not more, you know, it's like, this is the actual, you know, piece of the door of the spaceship that they escaped in or whatever it was. And
oh, right. Or the bell that they rang supposedly to bring stuff to order. And it was supposed to be originally a bowl, but a very particular kind of bowl.
It was
bowl.
A pickling crock bowl.
Yeah.
Right.
But then the guy was like, well,
yeah. Have you noticed that it's not even really the proper shape?
Yeah. They're like, you know, it's unlikely that they would make a pickling jar of that shape because you actually need to cover it and make sure everything's submerged and everything like that. That this just leaves it open.
Right. And so it's kind of a pointless lie. I mean, obviously somebody at some point just picked up whatever was handy and said, this is the pickling jar of destiny.
well, right. And so they talk about what's fake and what's not. And like, you know, I part of that same interview, you know, the author was saying like, well, people are talking about, oh, this is like a Rembrandt or something. And then it's like, it turns out that it's, instead of this very expensive Rembrandt, is a forgery that's worth, you know, basically nothing. And she's like, but when you look at it, it's, you can't tell the difference.
Right. It's all about how somebody values something versus right. its actual.
And so she's like, if, you know, is there actually a difference if you can't tell the difference? You know, it's like, is it just the concept of knowing that it's real is the important part, you know? And of course this reminds me of a Doctor Who episode.
Of course it does. Oh, really? I'm surprised. I thought we were going for Blake 7.
Yes. I'm sure there's something there too, but there was kind of an amusing part where, you know, he goes, you know, because it is time travel, they go back in time. And I think it's, I forget if it's a Da Vinci. I think it's the Mona Lisa, right? And he's funding his enterprises by, you know, in the past, he gets Da Vinci to paint like 7 copies of it.
Oh, yeah, this is a Tom Baker one?
Yeah. I think the episode was City of Death. But anyway, yeah, the funny part is he goes back and he actually gets Da Vinci to paint 7 copies. So they are real. They may not be the single copy, but they're real.
Doesn't that make all future copies worth 1/7 as much?
Well, so then the funny thing is that, you know, the doctor goes back and he says, well, you know, how are we going to deal with this? So he like takes like an indelible marker and writes fake, I think, on the canvas before he paints them. And so he's like, that'll show up an x-ray. But then the original real one that doesn't say fake got destroyed in a fire. And then so they had to put one of these, you know, real fakes, you know, up in the museum. And of course the person's like, well, but it says fake. He's like, yeah, but it was really painted by him. So, you know, what does it matter?
Well, it's like with the medieval Sharpie,
basically. Yeah.
But the Mona Lisa is really a good example of this, because the Mona Lisa was kind of an obscure painting, as I recall, until somebody stole it at some point. And then it became considered this, you know, really famous painting.
It kind of reminds me of like some episodes of Antiques Roadshow, right? Where people bring in all their, you know, junk from home and hope to God that it's worth something. Mm-hmm. Right. You know, but
half the time it's like, well, it would have been, but someone actually cleaned it up and refinished it. And now it's worth basically nothing.
Right. You know, because you trim the edges instead of, you know, having it properly restored, it's worth, you know, $100 versus $100,000 or something.
Right.
You know.
And it's weird because all this is all like, well, you know, it's only worth what someone's willing to pay for it unless it's, you know, priceless. And then that's kind of weird state.
I also think the point of it is that, you know, a lot of people are like, well, you know, we really never knew like how much it was really worth. But now we know that it's not really worth much, but it's still important to us. Right. Because this was, you know, great grandpa's or something. And
right.
You know.
It's like they're hoping it was something. But right. So there's this whole thing of like, you know, what. what do these vestiges really mean? And so the whole point from the beginning is the overarching plot is basically, you know, oh, this guy is sent to prison because he's basically stolen the originals, made forgeries and put them in their place, you know, replace them with exact duplicates.
Yeah. What was that Stephen Wright routine? You know, one morning I woke up and somebody had broken into my apartment and replaced everything with an exact replica.
Right. And so that's basically what he's sent to prison for.
Yeah.
And you find out towards the end, you know, cause, and then, you know, you think for a while he's a forger and he talks all about like how to, you know, he's like, you want to pick something that's, you know, hard to make, you know, it's hard to verify that it's a fake, but it's plausible that it's real and obscure enough that people don't know enough about it to prove it's fake.
Mm-hmm. Right. You just buy like old paper from, you know, like storage lockers from right. dead people from, you know, 25 years ago. Right.
Right. And then he's like, it's the same kind of paper. We'll just scrape this off and, you know, replace it. And so, you know, and then it turns out at the end, he's actually was sent there because he found out they were fake. He tried to tell, you know, father about it. And of course he doesn't want to come out. So he basically says, ship him off to prison. I don't want this, you know, this to come out and it looks bad.
Right.
That we have all these vestiges that aren't real for our family.
Don't worry, son. I'm going to get you out of compassionate removal.
Or not.
Or not.
You're going to become a vestige as well. Not needed.
But it's kind of a similar concept, you know, with the themes of, you know, the other big plot line is, you know, which of the kids is going to be named heir. Mm-hmm. And it's like, because they're both from, you know, different crushes, right? Like she's just essentially like an orphan.
She's a foster child.
Yeah. She's a foster from some public place, which implies, you know, low birth status of some kind. And then her brother was
even in the beginning, they were kind of like implying that, you know, it was sort of like the in vogue thing to do, like was to adopt.
Oh, sure.
You know, kids from, you know, public crushes or something. It sounds like it's like some sort of orphanarium or
right,
something like that. And, you know,
right.
And like they never really expected them to obtain the mantle, but this one guy is actually like adopted and is next in line.
Right.
Well, that's the assumption, but right. He hasn't been named, you know. Ingray, the main character, you know, is kind of doing this whole thing to try to curry favor with Mother. Right.
Right. And yet it sort of seems like she just actually has a lot of imposter syndrome. She's actually pretty bright, and she's seen as the sane one in the family.
She's not very good at crime.
She's not terribly good at crime. She's the non-Barry.
She's not particularly like a politician, obviously.
Right.
You know,
she just hasn't taken the proper amount of time to think these things through and actually go into it with a plan.
Actually, also, that was one of the things
pro tip, never spend all your money up front.
Yeah, seriously.
Whoops, you need to have enough money for the cab fare and, you know, some kind of hamburger or something.
A brick of ramen.
Well, exactly.
Yeah, that was something that I did want to talk about was I could never figure out. She would sometimes be shockingly naive for somebody who grew up in the middle of this sort of cynical political family.
Yeah.
She spent all of her money to get this guy out of compassionate removal. And her plan was, you know, like underwear gnomes model. I mean, it was like, you know, step one.
Did you say underwear gnomes?
Yes.
Okay.
Step one, steal underwear. Step two.
The South Park episode.
Profit.
Well, step three is always profit.
Exactly.
Doesn't matter what step two is.
Exactly. And so, yeah, her first step was get guy out of prison that supposedly stole thing that, you know.
But you have no idea if he's going to cooperate with you.
Right. Step two, you have no money. You have basically tickets to get him back home, but you had no way of forcing him. It was actually a stroke of luck that he showed up in a hibernation pod.
Right. You really should have gotten a gun beforehand.
Yeah, exactly. So if he just said, no, I'm not going to do that.
What he does.
Right. Or actually what he does say is, Palad Brudrakim, who's that?
Right. Right.
She manages through sheer luck to get him home. And I was sort of astonished that
it's basically through no skill of her own.
Yeah. She seemed to just luck out time and time again. But every once in a while, somebody would say, oh, she's brilliant. You know, she just needs 20 minutes to sort of get her head around the situation or something like that. And so I was wondering if, you know, well, were they deluded or was I deluded?
No. You're the Lebowski. I'm the dude.
Well, I mean, she seemed like the nice one in the family, right? She wasn't really the traditional
politician. Oh, and I liked her a lot. And I kind of liked her sort of skating from thing to thing. This part is not a criticism of the novel. But yeah, she was, like you say, the nice one.
But I mean, the interesting thing is that she does this whole thing, you know, essentially because she doesn't have an identity for herself, really. Her identity is that she's the one who is not going to get the identity and she's going to get kicked out.
Very good. Okay. I like that.
And so the entire thing is like, well, what is something without, you know, without a name in this culture, or at least to her?
Right. So, yeah, she's trying to act outside of her own identity in order to sort of build herself up, ironically enough, to get her mother's name.
And then by the end, she's offered it and she's like, nah.
Right.
I don't really want it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and the funny thing was, by the time she essentially volunteers to go and exchange herself for the kids that were being held hostage and her mother, I'm thinking, okay, she's going to get offered to be the next in line. Sure. You know, that kind of, it's like you said, it's Chekhov's, you know, hostage situation or something. Yeah.
I kept waiting for, you know, some sort of amazing thing to happen with the hairpins.
Oh yeah. That too. There's so many things. And I mean,
I'm like, they're going to turn out to be like explosives or, you know, vestiges or, you know, secretly some sort of gun, or maybe it turns into a knife that she actually is used to kill the guy who got killed by the knife.
I'm almost wondering if Anne Leckie was doing this sort of thing deliberately, you know, deliberately just like, oh, and here's a red herring for a thing that might happen.
It's a book full of herrings.
That is a very Agatha Christie type, you know, we have a couple red herrings. I mean, yeah, was it that? It also occurred to me, like, you know, hairpins are considered a very gendered item.
Sure.
You know, she does a lot of, you know, gender things in her books, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that was it or not.
Or, I mean, I think it was just an endearing character touch.
Yeah. I mean, help identify with somebody or.
But towards the end, that, like you said, you know, they specifically say, please take your hairpins out. And then they act like they're going to explode. They couldn't, they have these like mech hands that are too clumsy to pick them up and stuff. And then they carefully put them inside a drawer inside another mech. And then like later on, they even explicitly mentioned they were looking for the pins and they weren't there. And you're just like,
this was deliberately written to drive us insane, wasn't it?
Yes. The whole point of this book was hairpins.
I'll get those SF3 podcast guys back. Watch this.
You know, I was thinking too, because there's, you know, this kind of goes into not just the naming, but sort of like the parent-child relationship of, like, you know, is name transference like the only thing you can give a child, or like how big of a thing is it?
Mm-hmm. Well, in this case, it sounds like when her mother would pass, right, that if you weren't named a successor, then you're basically out of luck. Right?
Well, you're on the mercy of the eldest child.
Right.
Right. Or not the eldest.
Which, if you don't get along with them, then.
Right.
Right. And that, you know, it's not like a law, you're out. It's like, it's just like, well, you're not king or whatever. So yeah, you're on the mercy.
But you're going to be at a, you know, the mercy of a stipend every month or something, or.
Yeah. Unless you have your job still.
I mean, even was, you know, the Captain Wazine was just like, you know, maybe your best bet is really just to go, you know, get yourself like a decent job and with like your contacts.
Like, they're jerks.
Right.
Well, and he was very matter of fact guy.
Yes. Yeah.
He's like, so you don't really seem as great at, you know, your master plan of crime. You should really reconsider your options.
Exactly.
But even with him, you know, the Tick Cuisine or whatever, and like, so he's Gek, right? Yeah. And he's one of the Gek who is
Gek by adoption, basically.
But,
is he really adoption? He's really genetically Gek.
He was just one of the castoffs, meaning he was one of the ones that didn't, quote, swim down, whatever that was.
His gills didn't form properly, and so therefore he went into space and.
So
became a mech pilot.
Sure, but that was genetic engineering of some kind.
Oh, was it?
I mean, the Gek are basically blobs of slime, aren't they?
I'm not totally sure about that, but they at least said that there were some. Yeah.
If any Gek are listening, I did not mean that as an insult.
Actually, I think you're right. He did have genetic engineering.
Well, I think what they said is, you know, we took the humans and we, quote, you know, modified them. And so some of the modified humans have some of the same characteristics and they have gills.
So the Gek are basically the Vorlons.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's a Foster, essentially. He's another Foster.
But I think what they were saying is the way the Gek work is kind of like, you know, reptiles or whatever, where it's like, you know, we lay 1,000 eggs and 5 will survive.
Sure. What's it called? There's a particular kind of word for that, replication. And if I remembered what it was, I would sound really smart right now.
Probabilistic.
Sure.
That's not the real term, but. So yeah, it comes out through the Gek ambassador, I think, that they said, mm-hmm. That the reason that Tick Wazine, you know, because Tick Wazine is like, I got, you know, kicked out. I'm not a real Gek, and they wouldn't even let me stay on the planet. I have to live in orbit because I didn't have gills, basically.
Right.
it turns out that it, you know, this, they knew that the mother was very fond of this particular offspring, but that they could tell the offspring wasn't going to cut it when in the dog eat dog world or whatever.
Exactly. When it had to do the equivalent of the turtle babies running from shore.
Right. And so they specifically went out of their way to mess with their genetics kind of when they were small so that their gills wouldn't come in and they would be forced to leave, but then they wouldn't be killed. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of like another bizarre parent relationship, right? Where it's like, you know, I was fond of this one, even though I knew it was the runt of the litter. So we kind of kicked it out to make it live.
Right.
And it, you know, this one thinks that, you know, the parents hate it, but we, you know, really like this one the best, mm-hmm. You know, enough to go out of their way and, you know, maybe destroy their life within that culture just so that they wouldn't be killed.
Yes. And at the same time, through this incredibly complicated set of relationships, then Khaled Boudrakim / Gerald Kett, the guy who was rescued from prison, winds up being a Gek legally at the end, because that's how you can rescue somebody from prison when they don't have any legal identity.
It's like particular diplomatic immunity.
Yes, this is actually a huge crossover with Lethal Weapon.
Exactly. I will say Gerald Kett does sound like a very Star Wars name as well.
It does. It does.
I also want a Mobira 9000 portable phone if this is Lethal Weapon.
Oh,
yay. Yes. Oh, the good old days where phones weighed like 10 pounds. And
it's a luggable.
I will say I kept hearing for a while, it was Ingre Ox Gold. And I was like, you know, it sounded like Ox Gold for a little bit.
Yeah. Well, we should know by now how Anlecky spells things.
As in when I was going through the, you know, the Hugo version, it was spelled, you know, because they were saying, and then this other race, the and I was reading, oh, it really is spelled R-R-R-R-R-R. Like, you know, because I was thinking it was like, you know, like the U-R, the U-R.
Yes.
And like, so yeah, that is always the also weird thing with audiobooks is sometimes my brain just sort of goes, how is that spelled?
And that's Must my know. New ringtone.
Please send me a copy of that.
Yes. So yes, I'll do it by releasing a podcast.
If you'd like to join our Patreon level 17, you too can become a recipient of.
Yep. One of our Patreon goals is to, as we said before, start the Patreon. All right. So, favorite scenes. So, I'm going to diverge from my plan and say my favorite scene is at the end. It suddenly becomes a hostage drama because genre, what genre? And we have. We have these sort of badass military types that have a really faulty translator, and so they keeps on translating every swear as fiddlesticks.
Yeah, and others
it's not faulty. Like, it's just, you know, it's got the not safe for work sensor
exactly, you know,
filter applied to it.
Yeah, it's like golly,
right?
Gee willikers, beef. That might not be a good idea.
Yes, though I think Kevin may have been making an airplane reference.
Not then, but...
But you will in the future. Ha ha! I have one psychic power. I can tell when people will make airplane references in the future.
Good.
Wow, when's the next one going to occur?
I don't know when. I just know if.
Airplane.
There. You see, it happened.
The door is ajar.
Exactly. Yeah, so that was my favorite scene, was listening to these guys be incredibly badly translated and, you know, say things like, you know, void not being fiddlesticks.
Yeah, oddly, I think that was probably my favorite scene too. Just the fiddlesticks thing kind of jumped out as you know, kind of hilarious with the bad translation.
I'm a sucker for that sort of thing.
And you can kind of imagine like a universal translator like that, where it's just, you know, it's a very PC kind of, you know, traditional, you know, culture translation where people wouldn't swear, of course.
Like. Yeah, that would be hilarious because, you know, if the Federation had that, they'd be like, the Klingon Empire thinks they're at war with us?
So I think my favorite scene was probably the opening one where Ingre is trying to navigate the world of her first person napping. And mm-hmm. I was kind of hoping this was going to set the tone for like the entire book. It didn't turn out to be the case, but in all the ways that I expected, but it, I thought it was entertaining. She's like, well, you know, I'm out of money and this guy's going to make me, you know, open the box and then I got to figure out how to talk to Pallad, and hopefully it is Pallad. I mean, they told me it was Pallad.
The rest of the book is the next, like, you know, a few decades where she's just like working minimum wage to pay back her debt.
You're working at Secret Burger for the next 20 years and wondering if it's really Pallad in the burger or not. Yeah. I mean, even to the point where, you know, she's got this fake identity already pre-purchased for Pallad, and she basically just has to, you know, insert like a genetic sample.
Yeah, it's this right? Mad Lib thing.
Right. She's like, well, maybe I could use this identity, but, you know, I really don't look like Pallad. And like, yeah, you really haven't thought this thing through, have you?
All right. Okay. So usual questions. Was there tea? Nope. There was a tea-like beverage, Serbot. I think that Anne Leckie probably just had described tea too much in her previous novel, so had to drift over to this other one.
Well, they mentioned the tea in absentia, basically, you know, where the, you know, they had the Radshire or whatever complain that they didn't have any tea, I think, you know, one or two scenes.
Yes, but I cannot qualify that as having tea in the novel, or else things and not things would be the same.
That's true there, but it is explicit mention of not having it. So there's, you know,
it's like a special. I'm not entirely sure if I should give it more or less points for that.
It's a tea pointer to null.
Boy. Okay,
then. The variable exists, but you never used it. I don't understand.
God. So what character do you want to be, and or who would you be? Probably the Gek seems to have a...
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, too.
I think Barry would be the forger that did turn out to be a forger, but, you know.
Wasn't that everybody?
Needs more time crime.
Well, it's kind of like thinking about time crime.
It's kind of like thinking about time crime, the Kevin story.
It's like they were thinking about tea, but then they never followed through.
Thinking about tea.
Okay.
The guy who dies by knife.
Yes, well, we all might it's wish like, that the other was the guy who dies by knife.
If you want a higher quality character list out of this, you know, for these podcasts, you should do it your damn self.
I did some of them. I just couldn't remember it either.
Guy with knife and gut.
Okay. Well, I think it's time for us to sign our show notes and turn them into priceless vestiges, because no one would ever make these things up as a forgery.
I've been throwing these things in the recycle bin every week.
Well, that just makes them more valuable.
Right. Oh. The ones that we save.
I'll just print out more of them.
Yes. As we mentioned before, if you want to reach us, you can email us at sf3podcast@gmail.com or reach us at Twitter at sf3podcast. Give us some reviews in the Apple Podcast app or on iTunes. And as we said before, we shall return, for we are sci-fi.
Sci-fi.
Sci-fi.